Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste, I'm Divina Gupta, and on this edition we're talking about how China's slowing economy is actually helping some countries. Also, from cooling economies to cooling appliances that are becoming dangerous for our planet. We take a look at the latest United Nations report and find out how a business in India is using solar energy to run a cold storage unit.
The whole idea is obviously to improve the shelf life of the produce, and they can withdraw the produce they're storing with us at a time when the prices are higher, which obviously goes directly into, you know, improving their livelihoods.
And South Korea's plan to make dog meat farmers move away from their profession. For that, you'll have to wait a bit. So let's start with China. We've been talking about this country a whole lot this week. The world's second largest economy that has been slowing down for some time, with a struggling property sector and a high youth unemployment. So here's some Chinese graduates we spoke to on our sister program, Business Daily, about what's it like looking for a job.
After working for about 4 years, I suddenly felt that there was no such thing as happiness. Life was meaningless. I suddenly wanted to say, I give up. Under normal circumstances, the wage should be around 9,000 yen or even 10,000 yen a month. That's about $1,400. But during the pandemic, I was making just a quarter of that sometimes. Imagine that, in Chengdu. It barely covered my rent. I felt hopeless. I felt like lying flat. I needed some extra special mental strength just to get up in the morning. Waking up early every day, going to work, doing repetitive tasks, and earning only a meagre salary. It was so pitiful. Why do people live like this?
When they let go of an employee, they immediately receive hundreds of resumes for others. There is no shortage of candidates. Most of the job positions matched my skills, and there were many projects available. So it was relatively easy to find one. But now I can hardly get any responses.
You can hear more of those stories on our sister program Business Daily wherever you get your podcasts. But this week, it's been a case of all the king's horses and men trying to turn the economy around. First, China's central bank announced changes to its rate policy, making it easier for people to borrow money. Then the government also gave a one-time cash handout to the poor, which will start next week. And today, in a rare statement, the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party, the Politburo, said they were willing to give further stimulus. Now, this September meeting is not usually a forum for macroeconomic discussions, which suggests that there's a growing anxiety for slowing of this economy. So I spoke earlier with the BBC's China correspondent, Stephen McDonald, to find out what exactly is happening.
The main two problems, I should say, are unemployment and the collapse in the housing market. Now, unemployment is a big problem because it means you've got all these overqualified delivery drivers and people who've got, say, a master's degree in physics and end up working as cleaners because there just aren't enough jobs to go around for all the university graduates. Now, with the real estate sector, it means that for a lot of people, their life savings, imagine you put that into an apartment, and in some cases, the apartment is never built. Never delivered. And now the Chinese government has said it's going to rein that in. And we have this meeting today, chaired by Xi Jinping, no less, saying that the government is going to keep a tight control on all approvals for new housing because they want to somehow stabilize the housing market to attempt to give the economy a bit of a boost.
So you've talked about the property market in China, which has been quite sluggish. Now, the Chinese government has also given some cash handouts earlier this week. The People's Bank of China has also tweaked key rates. Now, are you seeing that there is some sort of signal that people are ready to spend?
And I think it's going to take a while for it to work, if it does work. The problem is, it might not work because families don't want to necessarily borrow. Why don't they want to borrow? Because the real estate market's in such a poor state. Why would you want to go and buy a flat in such a lousy market? And so that may not work, at least initially. And that's why today you've had these further measures announced saying that we're going to get on top of this. We're going to stabilize the housing market because they want to somehow inject confidence into that part of the economy. And bear in mind that the real estate sector was a quarter of all GDP in China at its height. So if that runs into trouble, well, it's going to hit young people's jobs straight away. But then you've also got the service industry. If it becomes sluggish, and it has been, that's another area where young people used to get jobs. And the tech sector also, it's been hit not only by the Chinese government cracking down, but now potentially they're looking at more difficulties because of tariffs from the US and Europe. So this is three big areas which were soaking up huge numbers of young people for jobs. Now, unless those big parts of the economy can be turned around, I think youth unemployment will continue to be a problem.
So what are they telling you when you speak to families in China? How hopeful are they of a turnaround?
The big problem here, of course, they've got, which a lot of countries would find it hard to believe, is deflation instead of inflation. The reason they've got deflation, imagine someone thinks, well, you know, I'm going to buy a couch, but the price keeps going down. If I can see the price going down, why buy one if you think it's going to go down even further? So they keep waiting. The longer they wait, the more the price goes down. The more the price goes down, the longer they wait. And this is happening in all these different industries. And so this hope from the government that ordinary people will just go out and start spending more and consuming more, and it's not happening. Now, sure, in some parts of the economy, electric vehicles, solar panels, they were doing really well, especially compared to housing or what have you. But I don't think they're panicking either. So you can't just keep producing cheap goods forever. The government wants to move this economy into building more high tech. Now, that's a painful process. You can't do that overnight. And I think, you know, even though there's a lot of concern at the moment in that people aren't spending money, they're just hanging on to it, I don't think they expect it to last forever. I think they think things will turn around.
The question is when, though. That's BBC's Stephen McDonald from Beijing. Emma Wall is head of investment analysis and research at Hargreaves Lansdown. She's joining us now. Emma, this question, when is China's economy going to turn around?
Well, it's a multi-trillion dollar question. China's very much hoping that these measures, and it's not just the property measures that we've heard announced today, it's also the monetary policy measures of cutting rates that they had earlier in the week. And there's also reports of bond issuance far and above expectation that we're seeing coming through in the wires now. And all of this combined is not just about boosting domestic confidence. It's also about boosting international confidence. And we've seen this in the markets. The markets have popped around 4%, both the Hang Seng, which is the Hong Kong market, and the Shanghai Composite, so the onshore China market. Whether this will be enough to get sustained economic growth, I'm not sure it will, because actually some of the things that are mostly holding back the Chinese economy are not domestic issues. Yes, the property market is extremely influential in generating growth, but also a lot of the issues that China are facing are international. It's the tariffs. It's the allies that it has and has not got globally. It's what's going to happen in the White House in a couple of months' time. So these measures alone will help, but they won't be sufficient to get China back to where it would like to be without that international element as well.
Well, the news that you talked about, the government in Beijing, they are planning to issue a special sovereign bonds worth about $200 billion this year, just for a fresh start for this economy, a restart to say. But till the time that happens, and a lot of these factors, Emma, that you've mentioned are also out of China's control, the macroeconomics, the situation which is happening in other countries, especially the US, till the time that happens, Is it then also pivoting many companies towards other global economies? So hold on to that thought, because I want to get in to how India's neighbor, China's neighbor, India, is trying to attract many of these companies, like Apple's supplier Foxconn has already started making iPhones there. So earlier I spoke with Sunil Vachani, who is the chairman of Dixon Technologies, which makes electronic components in India, if they're benefiting from China's slowdown.
Well, it's more than China plus one. You see, because now today, if you look at what are the advantages, right, of manufacturing in India, one, it's a huge, huge domestic market, right? And also it's underpenetrated, where the penetration of consumer durables, appliances is extremely low. Hardly, 10% of the people own a washing machine, hardly 15% or 20% of the people own a LED television. So it's going to be a massive market in times to come. Combined with that, the pool that we have of people and also the favorable government policies, that makes it a huge attraction, a very attractive destination for manufacturing, as I mentioned, not only for the domestic market, but for exporting to the world. So today, if you're looking at, let's say, scaling up manufacturing, if you're looking at it to our neighbor, there is no better country than India now.
What about the supply chains that are established? Because a lot of raw materials which are used by manufacturing companies like yours actually come from China.
And now we have a situation where we manufacture almost 100% of the products that are sold in the country. And now the category of electronics has emerged as the fourth largest as far as exports is concerned. Right? So we've traveled a very long way. And if you see countries like Vietnam also, their value addition in a product like mobile phones is hardly about 25%. And this is after manufacturing for the last 15 years that is happening there. And we, in a very short period, have already reached that.
But can India truly move away from this kind of reliance from China?
Well, you see, let's look at this that way, that, you know, we are not going to be manufacturing every component and have large scale for that. There'll be some components that, you know, countries will always be dependent on each other. And you see that happening everywhere, whether it is Korea, China, Taiwan. You know, there are certain hubs which are generated for a few components. It's not that we'll be doing every component ourselves, we'll be doing everything ourselves. There'll always be that dependence, interdependence.
How much of a competition do you see countries like Vietnam or Indonesia are becoming to Indian manufacturers?
Today, the kind of environment that is there for manufacturing in India, it's unbeatable. You look at the government policies, you look at the tax rates, you look at the large pool of manpower, you look at the large domestic market. If you put all these things together, it's a package which is kind of unbeatable. And no other country has that advantage, right? And, you know, you talked about countries like Vietnam. There is already we believe there's a shortage of manpower happening. There is a power shortage. Now, whereas in India, it's completely a different story right now.
That's Sunil Vachani, chairman of Dixon Technologies, talking to me from India. Emma, do you share this optimism? Can there be alternative to China and other countries in the region?
Yeah, I do. I'm also cautiously optimistic about the very long-term outlook for China as well. And we've been speaking to quite a lot of international businesses that are either choosing to go to countries other than China in the region, or they're hedging their bets and they're having some operations in China, but some operations in a nearby country, so that should China become more difficult to do business in, they can quickly switch without significant disruption to their supply chains.
All right, we leave it there. You're listening to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Now to some other news. The world's largest oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, seems to be changing its ways of managing oil prices. Traditionally, it's controlled the production of oil along with oil consortium OPEC. But now, reportedly, it's ready to abandon this practice, an unofficial price target of $100 per barrel. Emma, what do you think is behind this move?
So it's all about power and all about the amount of market share that Saudi Arabia has. It currently only has around 10% of the global supply, but unfortunately, and it used to have considerably more. I'm sorry, there seems to be an issue on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead. Go ahead, Emma.
Sorry. So Saudi Arabia used to have considerably more market share when it comes to supply, and now it's just below 10%. And so what it's actually trying to do is it's trying to play the long game by flooding the market in order to get more control and more market share, so that in the long term it has more power over the price of oil. Because in recent years, lots more supply has actually come to the table from other countries, including the US, which now supplies about 20% of the global market. So this is a bid to sort of play the long-term game and get more supply power.
And how are you observing other companies, oil companies, reacting to this?
I mean, ultimately, it's a negative for oil companies. Obviously, the higher the prices, the better it is for companies. We saw that actually in the in the height of when Putin first invaded Ukraine, you saw record profits and record revenues from some of the major oil players. So, you know, lower prices is not a good thing for major oil companies.
And Emma, the other news that we've been speaking on World Business Report about is from Pakistan, where the International Monetary Fund has cleared yet another bailout package for the country to the tune of over $7 billion. Now, what does this mean for Pakistan? And also, these loans come with a lot of conditions like increasing taxes and having that those austerity measures may not be exactly populist with people.
No, and actually I saw quite a surprising stat that I didn't realise until today. This is actually the 22nd time that the IMF has bailed out Pakistan since 1958. So it's currently the country's fifth largest debtor. So this, you know, this deal has taken quite a long time to deliver. They've been locked in talks since June. You know, a lot of the conditions were initially pushed back on. You know, they've been called strict, but they have got to a place now where the 37-month loan programme is agreed, and the country has stated that it hopes it will be the last time it needs the IMF to bail it out.
You know what they say, right? Fingers crossed. So Emma, stay with us because I want to take our listeners to a country where we don't talk much about it, but today in South Korea, we've seen that the government is planning to rehome dogs bred for consumption and compensate the few remaining farmers after a new law banned rearing the animals for meat. The government has said almost 500,000 dogs were being raised for food and it would try and facilitate their adoption. It's also offering farmers up to $450 per animal before a grace period runs out in 2027. I earlier spoke with BBC's Yuna Koo, who is a journalist in South Korea, about this.
So according to today's announcement, the government would pay minimum £127 to maximum £340 per dog if they agree to shut down their business. And dog farmers have voiced strong opposition to the proposed ban, arguing that the government is infringing on their right to operate their business.
How big is the dog meat industry in South Korea?
There are still some dog meat restaurants running in South Korea. However, the number has been decreasing over decades because demand has been shrinking rapidly. Considering the nature of the business, it's hard to find an exact number at this point, but it is known that there are now about 3,000 dog breeding farms in the country, which is a significant decrease from 10,000 in the early 2010s, but also higher than the government estimate, which is about 1,000.
And as you said, that those farmers have rejected for now this government proposals. How are people reacting to this?
People seem to have divided opinion on dog meat ban. Unlike in the past, not many people, especially those who are young, do not enjoy dog meat in South Korea. According to a Gallup poll last year, only 8% of people had tried dog meat in the past 12 months, which is a significant decline from 27% in 2015. However, many of those who do not eat dogs do not necessarily welcome the ban. Some people point out that the government is restricting people's freedom, and some are saying, how is it different from consuming cows, pigs, or other type of animals? On the other hand, of course, pet lovers, activists, and many more are saying this is a time to end this centuries-old practice and celebrate this decision.
Are there people who are willing to move away from this profession?
Actually, I've interviewed several dog farmers in the past, and they were saying that they have been operating this business for a long time, and they are saying it's hard to find another profession if they shut down their business. So it seems like before the bill takes into effect, the dog farmers will keep on opposing to this bill.
So what happens from here on now? Will the government revise their offer?
I think it shows that the government is making the dog meat ban bill in a more detailed way, because when the government just announced that the dog meat will be banned by 2027, they were met with a huge opposition by the dog farmers. However, this time they are trying to persuade dog farmers by giving them quite a lot of subsidies and incentives. However, the dog farmers are saying that this isn't enough.
That's BBC's Yuna Koo from South Korea. Now, a UN report has warned that a surge in demand for cooling systems in developing countries in Asia and Africa is hindering efforts to limit global warming. The United Nations Environment Agency warns of a sevenfold increase in the use of air conditioning, fridges and refrigerated transport in Africa by 2050 and a 300% increase in Asia. Demand is mainly being driven because there is a climate change phenomenon, which is leading to rising temperatures, increasing populations and urbanization as well. So we spoke to some people about it. In Kenya, these traders explain how cooling systems can bring a positive impact on their lives and businesses.
Kazi ya maembe iko na challenge mingi sana. Maji ikiingia kwa maembe kesho yake.
Selling mangoes has a lot of challenges. When the mangoes get wet, they usually start rotting the next day. We use polythene bags to prevent the mangoes from getting wet. We use umbrellas to protect them from the direct sun. We don't keep them in a fridge. We just store them in our wheelbarrows and cover them.
I sell French beans and green peas. Sometimes they rot when exposed to water because we lack proper storage. We usually leave the vegetables that we do not sell here at our stands, and we just cover them with sacks as we do not have good storage. It would be nice to have good storage facilities.
This cabbage business has challenges. From the time the cabbages are harvested from the farm and transported to the market, especially now that it has rained, you can't keep them fresh for a long time as they easily get rotten. When they rot, profits drop. If I had a fridge, things would be better.
So those are some concerns from traders in Kenya, but there are solutions as well. Amit Sarogi is the founder of a startup, Urja, a farming service company that provides solar-powered refrigeration products in India.
The whole idea is obviously to improve the shelf life of the produce, and they can withdraw the produce they're storing with us at a time when the prices are higher, which obviously goes directly into, you know, improving their livelihoods and generating more income for them. And with that extra disposable income, they can have a better standard of living, you know, send their kids to better schools, have better healthcare facilities for their family and so on and so forth.
How much support have you got from the government as well? Because the government in India is quite keen on expanding this kind of cold supply chain. They've given some tax breaks. Do you think that's been helpful and enough?
There are schemes, both the central and the state level. It's just a little too bureaucratic. So yes, you could apply for subsidies, but you may not see them for 3 years. And I don't have that kind of time as an entrepreneur.
So Amit, in your view then, what more can India do to bring its cold chain up to the level we see in developed nations?
Well, a whole lot. It requires a lot of investment. So yes, it has to be both public and private, definitely. One last point I will make is it's not enough to only have a cold room infrastructure, but the entire logistical supply chain also needs to be built in. You need to also think about your reefer vans. For example, if it has to be transported from Lucknow to Delhi, which is, you know, 300-400 kilometers away, and you're going to then, you know, just transport it without any, you know, cold infrastructure available, then it's of no use anyway.
That was entrepreneur Amit Sarogi. So there are problems, and these solutions like a solar-powered fridge need to be scaled up. For that, you need financing and investment. So I caught up with Lily Riahi, who is from the United Nations Environment Programme, who says private funding for eco-friendly infrastructure is the way forward.
I believe that right now we have a moment of strong political will from countries. We need to see that will matched by private sector, by investors, by private finance, which is why this report is a timely moment. Why do I say that? Well, we had the Global Cooling Pledge, you know, that was launched at COP. And it had very strong commitments in there on very specific commitments on energy performance standards, on building energy codes, on, you know, improving efficiency of equipment by 50%. That was in the Global Cooling Pledge signed by 71 countries.
But looking at the US, if you talk about that, because that's also one of the largest emitters, is the country doing enough to address this problem?
Well, absolutely. I think that they are. They do have standards. They are deploying super efficient equipment, including for vulnerable communities. They are doing national heat planning and deploying nature-based solutions for communities. They are taking it very seriously and supporting internationally, among other countries as well, to provide access for industry to retool their appliances towards low GWP refrigerants. I think this report focused on unlocking finance from private sector for the Global South, because there's a great need there and there's a need to provide support.
Why is it that these cooling-related gases are coming from Asia and Africa, most of them, and that's where the problem seems to be, according to this report?
I wouldn't say that it's coming only from there. What you do see is that the Global South is on the front lines of impacts from climate change. That includes, you know, higher temperatures to locations. They're also having really fast population growth, economic growth, and so that's why you see a significant growth in demand for cooling. They're also starting from a different place than other countries, so they don't have access. Right now, 1.1 billion people mainly in Africa and Asia don't actually have cooling technology. So, of course, when you look at the numbers in terms of growth, it looks like a steep growth curve because they're starting from having very little access actually to cooling in many of those countries.
What are the possible alternatives if you don't take this technology, if you want to reduce these emissions from the modern technology?
The issue is that a lot of the technologies are being used are not efficient. And so, or they're using high levels of hydrofluorocarbons. So it's a refrigerant. It's a very potent greenhouse gas emitter. Like, cooling accounts for almost a fifth of global electricity consumption. That's significant. And that's where a lot of emissions come. So what we need to do is we need to have like higher efficiency equipment in cooling and in cold chain systems. So that means, you know, the whole supply chain for cooling for food as well needs to be more efficient. And for that, you need to implement like standards, but you also need to put in place financial instruments, which this report speaks about.
That's Lily Rihai from United Nations Environment Programme. Thank you also to Emma Wall from Hargreaves Lansdown for being with us. You've been listening to World Business Report. Do check out wherever you get your podcast, this show. See you next time. Namaste.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.